On Friday, President Biden met with leaders from Japan, India, and Australia, a group of four nations together known as the Quad, an alliance aimed at countering China. Now, each of those countries is a democracy, but one of them, in a recent report, was downgraded from free to partly free.
India's Prime Minister is appealing for calm as deadly protests against a controversial citizenship law continue to rage in the world's largest democracy.
India is backsliding on human rights and democracy, and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's brand of nationalism is creating a problematic alliance for President Biden.
Dozens of people have been killed in violence fueled by anger against a citizenship law, which opponents say discriminates against Muslims.
But as Politico's Nihal Tusi reports, amid a push to counter China, Biden administration officials haven't just kept their public criticisms of Modi to a minimum. They've even engaged in outreach to Modi allies known for their extreme views.
It fits the traditional trend of you have to go with the allies who are willing to go along with you, especially if you see a bigger enemy.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch. And today,
let me just say that, you know, foreign policy is frequently about making choices between not so great and really not so great.
Nihal Tusi on how Biden needs India to stand up to China, but it comes with a cost.
It seems like they're willing to overlook a lot of the anti-democratic and anti-human rights moves that Modi's government has taken over the years. He has led the country since 2014. He grew up a Hindu nationalist. Generally, it seems like there's been more violence against Muslims in particular and non-Hindus. There's a citizenship law that has made religion a basis for citizenship in a way that seems to exclude Muslims. There has been the decision to take away the autonomy that had been granted to Jammu and Kashmir region. That's a majority Muslim area. And there have been crackdowns in that area. There's also been crackdowns on political dissidents, journalists, people being charged with questionable offenses, basically because of their work. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where even though India still holds what are largely considered free and fair elections, this well-known organization, Freedom House, that kind of ranks democracies around the world, changed India's rating from a free country to a partly free country earlier this year because there seems to be these kinds of institutional degradations and attacks and human rights problems. So it's heading in the wrong direction is what a lot of human rights activists and others say.
You recently looked in your reporting at the difficulty of navigating the U.S.-India relationship, given these criticisms, but also the strategic importance of America's allyship with the country. Why is India such an important ally for the U.S.?
Well, it's, first of all, like more than a billion people. It's located next to China, has nuclear weapons. It's an important trade partner for the United States as well. In some ways, you could argue that India could, in theory, make up for some of the trade challenges that we face as our relationship with China devolves. Hmm. Also, India does not have a great relationship with China. They've even had some border fighting in recent years. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, some of them have been pretty violent, vicious fights between Indian and Chinese troops.
It happened on Monday high in the Ladakh region after a month-long standoff along the disputed border. The fighting wasn't with guns, rockets, or other modern weapons. In fact, no shots were reportedly fired. Instead, the deadliest battle between the two sides in 45 years was with fists, sticks, and rocks.
So it's like if you're looking at the region and you think, well, here is still a democracy, vibrant, full of many very, very talented and entrepreneurial people, and a leader that seems to want to work with the United States. You know, you go with the person who is offering to take you to the dance, I guess. I think I'm screwing up that particular saying, but I think people know what I mean.
Well, how is President Biden so far navigating his date to the dance, to keep with your potentially wrong and out.
Well, you know, Modi was one of the first world leaders that President Biden, quote unquote, met with. It was virtual because of COVID. But, you know, he was one of the first few they've spoken. Modi visited, obviously, last week. A lot of this has been done as part of the Quad, which is a group of countries, Australia, Japan, India, and the United States, that is not like a formal thing, but which the United States is trying to elevate because of China. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. has also just been very, under Biden, it's been just very quiet on the human rights stuff. It's almost more about what Biden and his team don't say than what they do say. For instance, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has recommended that India be called a country of particular concern because of the mistreatment of the Muslims in the country. There's like 200 million Muslims in India, by the way. It's a lot of people. But this administration has yet to decide whether to take that recommendation or not. And the previous administration would not do that because they too, under Trump, saw India in the same way. Mm. And so it's not like Biden's like the first guy to really kind of suck up to Modi.
Is there any tension or pushback within the Biden administration over how to handle this?
There's definitely an internal debate, but it seems like the more regional focused, you know, the kind of the real politique people are winning out, the China focused ones. The folks who are dealing with human rights issues, religious freedom issues, they don't have as powerful a voice in this or most many administrations. They generally don't, but they do feel like, you know, things are kind of on the wrong path. One recent thing that happened that was really surprising to a lot of people was that a U.S. diplomat who had been our top diplomat basically throughout the summer in India, he met with the head of the RSS, and that is this longstanding organization in India that is like very, very extreme in its Hindu nationalism. It's sometimes violent. You know, it has been banned for stretches of time in India, and it's very close to Modi. And our top diplomat there in India at the time met with the head of this group, and that just astonished human rights watchers. They just thought that was beyond the pale.
How would you say this fits more broadly into global trends and what we might expect in the coming years?
I think it's basically, it fits the traditional trend of you have to go with the allies who are willing to go along with you, especially if you see a bigger enemy. And so that's, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? That's the other version. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to some extent, it actually makes a lot of logical sense. Like, of course, you don't want to alienate India too when you're already dealing with China. And Russia, I mean, let's not forget about that. So it does seem like, you know, we're just doing what most practitioners of foreign policy would do. But, you know, it's interesting because one of Biden's big issues is this idea of making sure that democracies stand up to the growing authoritarian movements around the world. And yet, Modi arguably is very authoritarian in his thinking. And the question then is, how does this administration make sure that India becomes once again what Freedom House would consider a free country, that it does not lose its democracy over time as we are trying to partner with it to counter China? And that's really interesting. And I want to be clear, there's probably, I know there are conversations behind the scenes. I'm sure that it's not like our Secretary of State and others are not saying anything about human rights and democracy to Modi. But it's a question of at what point, you know, do we need to go public, or will this private pressure actually lead to some improvements in India on the human rights and democracy front? I think that is yet to be seen. But, you know, the Biden administration, they've been in office less than a year, so there's a long road ahead.
Nihal Tusi, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Also, today, former Virginia Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe holds a slight lead over Republican Glenn Youngkin in Virginia's gubernatorial race. That's according to a new poll from Monmouth University that comes just before the two are set to meet in their second and final debate tonight. In the poll, 48% of registered voters said they'd support McAuliffe, and 43% said they'd back Youngkin. Early voting is already underway in the election. And California is permanently shifting to universal mail voting. On Monday, Governor Gavin Newsom signed legislation that'll require elections officials to mail every registered active California voter a ballot in future elections, a move that could intensify partisan divisions of the voting process. California's embrace of more expansive voting processes contrasts sharply with Republican-led states that have clamped new restrictions on balloting, while Republicans pushing those changes call them a needed safeguard against fraud. The scant evidence of that has led Democrats and voting activists to decry new laws as efforts to suppress left-leaning voters. Today's episode included music composed by Breakmaster Cylinder. Be sure to subscribe to Politico Dispatch if you haven't yet. And while you're there, check out some of our other shows like Politico Energy and the Playbook Daily Briefing. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.